Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Rick Perry tripped up in a GOP debate when he struggled to remember the third government agency he'd cut if he became president.
The third agency of government, yeah. I would do away with the education, commerce, and let's see, the third one I can't, sorry, oops.
Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad pushed back against a UN report detailing new evidence that Iran was developing nuclear weapons.
This nation won't retreat even an iota from the path it is pursuing.
Penn State football coach Joe Paterno fired over a sex abuse scandal. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett said yesterday the most important thing to do was to help the victims.
We need to identify these victims of sexual abuse. We need to find them. We need to help them. They are our children.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable with David Ignatius of The Washington Post, Maggie Haberman of Politico, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? Iran, Perry's gaffe, the Penn State scandal. You can also comment on our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. David Ignatius joins us from Washington, D.C. He's columnist and associate editor at The Washington Post, also, of course, a novelist. His latest book is Blood Money, a novel of espionage. David Ignatius, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Bob.
Also with us from New York, Maggie Haberman, senior political writer at Politico. Maggie Haberman, thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
And as always, good to talk to Jack Beatty, the On Point senior news analyst from his perch in Hanover, New Hampshire. Hi, Jack.
Hello, Bob, Maggie, and David.
Let's start with politics. Another GOP debate this week, another night that was not Rick Perry's behind the microphone as he had trouble remembering the three federal agencies he would cut.
And I will tell you, it's three agencies of government when I get there that are gone. Commerce, education, and the, what's the third one there? Let's see.
You need five.
Oh, five. Okay. So commerce, education, and
EPA?
EPA. There you go. No, okay.
Let's stop deposition.
Seriously? Is EPA the one you were talking about?
Or? No, sir. We were talking about the agencies of government. EPA needs to be rebuilt.
But
there's
you
no doubt about
but
that.
But you can't name the third one?
The third agency of government, yeah. I would do away with the education, commerce, and let's see, I can't, the third one I can't, sorry, oops.
It was energy. I think a lot of people had the same reaction, not knowing whether to laugh or cringe at that, which went on for almost a minute. Maggie Haberman, is Perry toast?
I think Rick Perry's road forward is extremely complicated right now. You don't want to say anybody is toast in this cycle because it's been so bizarre, because the conservative electorate is so restive and has not really settled on an alternative to Mitt Romney, bouncing around from candidate to candidate. So I don't want to say he is toast, but I will say that he has serious problems. He was already having a tough road back after essentially collapsing in the polls in recent weeks because of bad debate appearances, among other things, but mostly because of bad debate appearances. All this did was underscore a narrative that he is not ready for prime time, that he doesn't have the heft to take on President Obama, that he couldn't stand on a debate stage with President Obama. It was also, I mean, candidly, it was a bizarre moment. We have all had moments like that where we have frozen up, but few of us have them on that grand stage. And at first, I admit, when I was watching it, I almost felt like it was self-parody because he has been so bad at these debates, and then absolutely was not. It was very, very strange. His team is doing the best that it can to try to do damage control in the last 2 days. They're aggressively going on offense. They're trying to make a joke out of it, put lipstick on the pig, for lack of a better way of putting it. I don't know if that's going to work. I think that's the best he can do right now. But so much of Rick Perry's candidacy has been about swagger and strength. That's how he ran in Texas. That's how he has run for the last 13 years or so, you know, starting from his lieutenant governor campaign into his gubernatorial campaigns. You know, he won a primary last year in Texas against Kay Bailey Hutchinson that he was not supposed to win. And in part, it was because of running a very smart, aggressive, tough campaign. He's now running from a position of humility, which is not really a familiar pose for him. I don't know that this is going to work, in large part because I think donors got incredibly spooked after seeing his debate performance the other night. He was already having some trouble raising money, I've heard from several people, in recent weeks as his poll numbers started taking a dive. There's just no way that this helps. And without money, he really can't continue that far on. His campaign says that it has enough to go through South Carolina. And that may or may not be the case, but, you know, I think that they are spending so heavily right now in Iowa that it's hard to see them being able to push forward without continuing to raise well.
David Ignatius, picking up on that image that Maggie painted for us a moment ago, is there enough lipstick out there for Rick Perry to fix this?
Well, he, as Maggie says, he was running as the Texas tough guy. This is a guy who takes a firearm with him when he goes jogging, projecting an image of strength is central to how he's campaigned. And in these debate performances, he's looked weak and vulnerable. He just looks like a man who would rather be anywhere than on the stage with the other candidates. I think he's tried to work around that. I'm not the debate guy. I'm not the quiz kid. We all remember the ways in which George W. Bush's inarticulate speech in a weird way ended up seeming to help him when he was running against John Kerry. John Kerry, perfect diction, almost too perfect. And I think there was a way in which the average person related to Bush. I think Perry's gone so far beyond that. I think the country is looking for somebody who can take the very serious economic problems that we have and try to fix them, smart enough, tough enough, clear enough in his own policies. And I think that Mitt Romney, through this campaign, through his debate performances, has really accentuated that aspect of his appeal. And standing side by side with Perry, you just see one person looks like more of a take charge guy. Interestingly, it's the man from Massachusetts, and another guy looks less prepared. So, simple answer, no, there isn't enough lipstick. But I think it's not the gaffe. I mean, anybody who watches that, it's painful. You think of moments like that we all have. But it goes to the fundamentals of the appeals that these candidates are making, and I think that's the weakness you can't overcome.
Jack Beatty, I know you've been thinking about Rick Perry in terms of Massachusetts, comparing it to Ted Kennedy's famous gaffe when asked in challenging incumbent fellow Democrat President Jimmy Carter why he wanted to be president, Ted Kennedy wasn't prepared.
Yes, that famous interview with Roger Mudd, he blathered on inconsequently. One still doesn't know what he meant. That was sort of the primordial question he should have been ready for. He wasn't. And many people think he lost his chance right then. I mean, these things happen famously to Winston Churchill, of all people, when he was 29 years old, a year after he crossed the aisle, crossed the floor and went from the Liberals to the Tories. He was giving a speech in the Commons, slamming the Tories, and he was going on, and he got to furthermore, and the tape broke. And the Tories started to hoot at him, and he finally had to just sit down and hold his head in his hands in shame. That was Winston Churchill. He never went out thereafter without having memorized his speech. And something like that could be said of Mr. Perry. He has not seemed ready in the sense of prepared for what he has faced. And I think Politico, Maggie's paper, raised this question in a sort of saucy headline when they said, you know, is Rick Perry too dumb? I mean, dumb meaning unprepared for what he's going to face. And that gets at such a ticklish question that the press is really loath to raise. That is, what about the intellectual preparation of candidates? Is it adequate? What about the way candidates who seem to do well at the state level flop at the national level. The McCain people were shocked, for example, in 2008 when Sarah Palin was revealed to be Sarah Palin. They thought, well, my gosh, she's a governor. She'll know about these things. Well, it's not necessarily so. And it's very hard for the press to even raise such questions about candidates because it looks like, God help us, elitism.
All right. So what's Perry's hope? You've all said that he's pretty much not gotten untracked. He's down in the polls, likely to be trounced by Mitt Romney in the first primary state, New Hampshire. So what's his strategy? What's his hope? Maggie?
I think he really needs to essentially be living in Iowa at this point. He hasn't been doing quite that. It's been a bit of a surprise. I mean, he needs to basically be the governor of Iowa or running for it. If he doesn't win Iowa, there is no path forward. And certainly if he doesn't finish Iowa ahead of Mitt Romney, there's really no path forward. In South Carolina, his numbers have gone down pretty substantially. And, you know, that was a state that's another southern state. It was expected to be a gimme for him. At this point, if he won Iowa, he would go into South Carolina with a tremendous head of steam. He's not going to win in New Hampshire, Rick Perry. New Hampshire has been famously, you know, averse to southern governors. George Bush discovered that pretty well, that there is a cultural issue there. And Mitt Romney obviously has home state advantage. So if it's a two-man race between the two of them, Rick Perry is not going to succeed over Mitt Romney there. But if he wins Iowa, he does have a path forward. He goes into South Carolina well-positioned. The money would start coming back in that is not coming in now. And then things would go to Florida. And so I don't quite understand. I get going to New Hampshire every couple of weeks or so, but he's going back to New Hampshire next week from what I saw on the calendar. I don't completely understand it. You know, I think that he also needs to be doing town hall after town hall after town hall, and again, he's just not there yet.
This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about this week in the news. We're joined this hour by David Ignatius of The Washington Post, Maggie Haberman of Politico, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's stay on the presidential race for just a moment and the challenges facing Texas Governor Rick Perry on the campaign trail. Bruce is calling On Point from Essex, Massachusetts. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Bob. Rick Perry's brain freeze is interesting, but the real significance was what he froze on, which was a list of departments he would do away with if elected president. His delusion that presidents have such a power seems to be shared by most candidates and their supporters. You know, Mitt Romney, Herman Cain, all appear to believe that presidents can do, you know, just wipe out the present tax code and put in a different one or whatever. What country are they running to be president of?
Jack Beatty, brain freeze on campaign rhetoric. Is a brain freeze when you're speaking simple campaign rhetoric an even bigger problem than a brain freeze in a casual conversation?
Yes, is the short answer. But, you know, to Bruce's point, the insouciance with which they say, well, we'll abolish this and throw out that. It's not that easy. Congress has got to have a big say. But I think it does give a picture of the values and the judgment of the candidates. I mean, do you really feel that the United States would be better off in a world where economic competitiveness is ebbing from us without a Department of Education, without a federal role in education? Is that something you think would make the nation stronger? You know, Ronald Reagan ran on that in 1980. There was talk about ending the Department of Education, which had just begun. But Republicans got away from that. And George W. Bush actually extended the federal role in education. So I think it does show, to me, a short-sighted view of any idea of the candidate's comprehension of competitiveness.
All right. Another call on the campaign and the candidates. Mike is calling from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Bob. Great panel. Great show, you guys. Listen, you know, one of your panelists mentioned a little while ago about, you know, it's kind of a fine line with journalism, a journalist asking or coming off as elitist, expecting too much, or George Bush being the kind of guy that, you know, would you elect somebody that you would want to have a beer with? And my answer to that is no. My feeling is no. I want somebody in that position and on the world stage to be an elite person. I mean, you know, we went through 8 years of somebody who could barely string a sentence together and was an embarrassment on the world stage to us, calling the Magna Carta the Magnum Charter, and it was embarrassing. And you talk about cringe moments. I would want somebody that sits around and has a beer with me to be president? Probably not. I mean, do I want to be able to relate to that person and them to be somewhat of an quote unquote everyman? Yes, but you know, we're talking about you know, the job description. There's just too much at stake to say, hey, we want a back slapping everyman Joe. To be, you know, it's not that type, it's not a high school football coach position. This is a totally different situation. And it seems to me that, you know, look at the credibility of a lot of our candidates. And we look at the students and that watch the debates and watch the elections and from the education standpoint of our country. And we talk about how our education standards have gone down. Look at the people that we have in our spotlight now. It's more important to be a celebrity than to be well-versed on subjects and to be somewhat elitist.
So, Mike, let me ask you this question. Is there anyone on the Republican stage right now who would make you feel special or who would make you think that he or she could make the United States feel special and elite in terms of our place in the world?
I would have to say that their track record, really, when you go to Sarah Palin and George Bush, and it is not very good. But I would say right now, from the stable that's there now, I would have to say Mitt Romney or somebody like Ron Paul, to me, would be the most credible.
All right, Maggie Haberman, let me ask you this. Is Mitt Romney the luckiest candidate in years to be able to sit back and watch pretty much all those around him simply implode?
It really is something. His luck has been astonishing this cycle. We all talk about it. He certainly is skilled at debates, and I keep going back to debates because they have driven so much of the narrative and so much of how this race has been covered. By this time in 2007, Republican candidates had not only raised a lot more money collectively, but they were also largely on television. Right now, only Rick Perry and Ron Paul are on TV actively. Michelle Bachmann had an early self-defining ad. Tim Pawlenty was on at some point. But it's not, you know, the airwaves war that we've seen in the past. And so the debates have become real indicators, and Mitt Romney is extremely good at them. There's no question. And he also has the benefit of having run before. I think that one of the things that this race illustrates is how important the experience of going through a campaign can be on a presidential level. It's obviously not the end-all, be-all, looking at our current president, but it who had not run for president before and obviously did quite well in that campaign. But it does help, and it has helped Mitt Romney. But yes, the luck factor has been astonishing. If you look at Mitt Romney's polling numbers, they have basically stayed the same. Throughout much of the last 6 months, he's been at what people describe as a ceiling. At a minimum, it's certainly a soft ceiling of about 25% in national polls. And then in some of the statewide polls, it's a little different, the exception of New Hampshire. In New Hampshire, he's anywhere between 35% and a little bit over 40. But he has had the benefit of candidates who have just been imploding and or, if not imploding, distracting from him. I mean, I think that's been what's been pretty remarkable about the last couple of weeks is that you had Rick Perry at the debate, and that has driven several news cycles. Before that, you've obviously had what's going on with Herman Cain. Simultaneous with the Herman Cain story has been Rick Perry getting questions about an overly exuberant speech he gave in New Hampshire that prompted a lot of questions about whether he was on something. It is never a good day when a candidate is having to say, no, I wasn't drunk when I gave that speech, or no, I wasn't taking something, and no, I wasn't taking back medicine. And so all of this has really augured in Mitt Romney's favor. He has not had to really do anything or change anything. We are almost at December. And he has barely set foot in Iowa, and yet he might win Iowa. It's an astonishing, astonishing cycle.
Just the same, as Maggie points out, David Ignatius, Romney can't seem to crack the 25% level of support in the GOP, at least in the national polls. If he wins the nomination, do you think he can win the White House with a lukewarm Republican Party behind him?
It depends, above all, on where the economy is. If the economy still feels to people like it's in a deep recession, that Obama's policies are not working. I think that the sort of brute competence that Mitt Romney shows, which I think is part of why he never seems likable, warm and fuzzy in the way that Americans do in the modern era like their candidates, that problem for him will become less skewed. I think people, if in the spring the economy we're seeing milder economic weather, I think Barack Obama looks in much better shape. But if it's still where it is today, I think you could see Mitt Romney's basic appeal to the country, implicitly saying, I'm not the warmest, cheeriest. I'm not Bill Clinton. I'm not going to joke with you, but I can fix these problems. I know what I'm doing. I think he's found a way in the debate so far to present that message clearly and cleanly. In each debate, I've been struck by that, and so I think he'd be formidable in a general election campaign, if you have an economy that frightens people, where frightened people are looking for somebody who can fix things.
Jack Beatty, I know the Romney campaign has said that it believes the GOP will warm up once the voting starts and he, Romney, starts winning. Do you buy that?
I think they'll warm up some. Whether they'll do it enough to really make a difference, that's a question. I mean, the enthusiasm gap, we've talked about it a lot on the show, has been in the GOP direction. Will some of that drain out if he's the candidate? The thought of Barack Obama as being reelected will concentrate many Republican minds, and I think will make Mitt Romney seem just by the polls, for example, in Pennsylvania, he's neck and neck with the president. No other candidate is close. He would put Michigan in play, even though he was against the bailouts. Clearly, Michigan would be in play, crucial Democratic state. So just looking at the numbers, you have to say Republicans are probably going to have to come around to the reality principle sooner or later.
All right. And now Herman Cain, even though we've now heard the voices of his accusers, those accusing him of sexual harassment, Herman Cain stands firm, denying those accusations. Here he is from a news conference on Tuesday.
As far as these accusations causing me to back off and maybe withdraw from this presidential primary race, ain't gonna happen. Because I'm doing this for the American people and for the children and the grandchildren. And I will not be deterred by false, anonymous, incorrect accusations.
One of his accusers was Sharon Bialik, the first woman to publicly come forward to accuse him of sexual harassment. Here she is from a news conference on Monday.
I want you, Mr. Cain, to come clean. Just admit what you did. Admit you were inappropriate to people. America is in a and then move forward. America is in a horrible turmoil, as we all know. We need a leader who can set an example which exemplifies the standards of a good person and moral character.
Jack Beatty, how's he staying afloat? Herman Cain, though he has sunk some, is still up in some of the polls.
He is, although I noticed that his intensity is flagging. Gallup had a poll out this week showing their intensity down 9 points in support for him. The Des Moines Register recanvassed a half a dozen or so of its respondents from a recent poll and found a lot of them, 11 of 15, were having second thoughts after Ms. Bialik's comment. The week before, when it was just anonymous sources from Politico, that showed no change. So I think there's some clear evidence there of some erosion. And then you look at the opinion leaders, Mona Charon, the conservative columnist today, a very strong column raising questions about him. Our own Howie Carr in the Boston Herald wrote about the Cain news conference. He was moved to cite Emerson. The louder he talked of his honor, the faster we counted our spoons. So there does seem to be some erosion of support among opinion leaders and crucially in Iowa.
David Ignatius, can Herman Cain possibly be the GOP nominee?
I would have guessed no before the sexual harassment issue, and I would feel even more strongly that way now. But it is interesting that his appeal from the beginning, I think, has been that he's the unpolitician, he's the anti-politician. He says in every comment, every gesture, I'm not going to play by the rules that you usually see in debates and campaigns. And there is that quality that looks like being straightforward, focused on his 999 tax plan. Even when people say it won't do what he'd been claiming, he just dismisses it. He won't play in the argument about numbers and how this would actually price out. And he's trying to do that now on quite serious charges. And just it's baseless. I won't talk about it. I won't dignify it by really responding. And he can try to tough it out that way. I think a lot's going to depend, and it's terrible to me that it comes down to this, on whether other women who have claimed that they were sexually harassed by him do come together on one platform and make what would be an emphatic and really unstoppable assault, really. I don't think he's going to be nominated, but I am struck by his success in making this unconventional, won't play the game by the usual rules approach work so far.
Maggie, I want to ask you something. Do you think that Kane knows that he's not going to be the Republican nominee? And if so, is he playing for something else down the line, a good media gig, maybe a run for the Senate at some point?
This has been speculation for months now because Herman Cain has not been running, as has been said here, a conventional campaign. But by conventional, it's not that he's doing things sort of outside the box. He's been basically out of early states, which is a very specific thing. He's barely been to Iowa. He's barely been to New Hampshire. He's barely been to Florida, although in Florida he is staffing up. And it's really Florida that vaulted him to credibility as a potential Mitt Romney alternative because he won the presidency 5 straw poll in September, and that was a game changer for him. There has been a lot of speculation that he is looking for a talk show or some kind of a Fox News gig has come up or some other platform. He insists that that's not the case, that he is running to be the nominee. I think that this is such a year of smaller government, redefining the role of government, for the Republican Party, and such an anti-establishment year that he has been resonating. He's also been doing something, to some extent, he's been filling a similar role that Mike Huckabee filled in 2007, which was Mike Huckabee did extremely well at the debates, and he was also seen as a very positive messenger. And Herman Cain has been very positive, prior to the last 2 weeks.
Let's hear from an on-point listener on this. David is calling from Marshalltown, Iowa. Hi, David.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. There have been a lot of Huckabee wannabes over the last 6 months. You can name the three or four that are still in there. You can name a number that didn't run. The problem is the Huckabee wannabes aren't a Huckabee. Huckabee's about the only guy out there that could give Romney a run for it, and he's decided not to run. So it's probably, at this point, Romney's race to win probably by a landslide.
Are you a Republican, David, calling from Iowa, or are you voting? Do you plan on voting in the Republican primary?
Yes, I do.
I'm sorry, the Republican caucuses in Iowa, I should say. And how are you going to come down?
Well, if it was today, it would probably be Michelle Bachmann. But it really is a fluid situation here. I like Rick Santorum too. But neither of those candidates are taken off. But I'll vote for who I think is the best, regardless of where they're at in the polls.
The best, even though the best, from your point of view, may not necessarily be the winner.
Exactly. I'm not going to vote for a guy who's going to win. How helpful is that?
David, thanks a lot for calling from Iowa. I'd like to ask Jack, Maggie, and David to stay with us. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news, TV personality and noted curmudgeon Andy Rooney died this week at the age of 92. He offered 60 Minutes commentaries for more than 30 years.
Something's got to be done about phone books. You know something I don't like? Chocolate chip cookies. Got a lot of paperweights. What's a paperweight for, anyway? Papers don't blow around in here.
Dr. Conrad Murray found guilty of the involuntary manslaughter of Michael Jackson. A fan outside the courthouse this week said the jury made the right call.
I'm glad justice was served to Michael. Why did this ever have to happen? He's gone. I'm just going to have a broken heart forever.
And former heavyweight champ Joe Frazier died this week at the age of 67. Smokin' Joe defeated Muhammad Ali in the so-called Fight of the Century in 1971. Join the conversation today. Are you observing Veterans Day? What's your reaction to the ongoing scandal over the treatment of the remains of America's war dead? We're joined this hour by Maggie Haberman of Politico, David Ignatius of The Washington Post, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Now on to the continent and Europe's financial crisis, which drove huge political changes in Europe this week. In Greece, Prime Minister George Papandreou is out. Lucas Papathimos is in as Prime Minister. In Italy, Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi has said he'll leave office maybe as early as this weekend. On Tuesday this week, opposition leader Pier Luigi Bersani called for Berlusconi's resignation on the floor of the Italian Parliament.
This vote has shown that the government no longer has a majority. And we all know over and over again we have a government with a credibility deficit. If you have a crumb of sense left in front of Italy, hand in your resignation.
David Ignatius, the Senate in Italy has approved austerity measures it says will help save the country financially. If it wins final approval, Berlusconi has said he'll step down. Do you think he will?
I think he will. I think that we'll have a government of technocrats in Italy headed by Mario Monti, probably, just as we will have a government of technocrats headed by Lucas Papademos. And they will try to fix things along the lines that have been demanded by the Eurozone authorities. But I have to say, the more I look at this crisis, the more struck I am by the fundamental structural problem. Each attempt to solve this, to patch together a solution for a Greece or an Italy, fails because the markets just start shooting at the weakest part of it. And I think at bottom, unless the Germans are willing to – German Chancellor Angela Merkel is willing to step up and really take this – Europe, this wounded Europe in Germany's arms and have a general expansionary monetary policy, make it easier for people to start growing again rather than imposing austerity. I mean, the truth is you cannot bleed this European patient to health. It doesn't work that way. Nope. And the Germans keep offering bailouts but then inflicting more punishment so that they'll feel that the sinful Europeans at the periphery are made to pay for their profligacy. It isn't working. It hasn't worked for 2 years. There's no reason to think it'll start working now. I think if the Germans won't do that, if they won't agree to a sort of accommodation, growth and expansion, then countries like Greece really are better off having their own currency again. Going back to the drachma, being able to adjust to changing circumstances in the way that economies do with changes in the value of their currency, changes in their standard of living that make them more competitive. Don't try to bleed them to death to stay in a currency where they don't belong anymore. So I think that's the choice, and it's a fundamental one. I think Europe keeps trying to duck it, and they should stop that.
So are you saying that the euro as a currency is on shaky ground as of today?
Well, it's obviously on shaky ground. You have a currency that's shared by the 16 Eurozone countries. who don't also share a common fiscal policy to make sure that everybody fits within the parameters defined by the euro. If you think of the United States during the years of the Articles of Confederation, which lasted from, 1777 to 1789, when our Constitution finally took effect. The Constitution was created a more centralized and in a sense, dominating central government, because the looser arrangement just wasn't working, especially in terms of trade and commerce, questions of money and how you'd finance transactions. Europe is in, weirdly, is in a kind of Articles of Confederation situation now, and I think it doesn't work any better for them than it did for us, and it's got to change.
Jack Beatty, you know, the U.S. has been looking at this from the point of view of investors who've seen their portfolios go up and then plummet sharply. What's the lesson for the U.S. in this?
Well, I'm not really sure. I thought Tom Gelton today on Morning Edition had a good analysis where he talked about the role that political leadership, the failure of political leadership, the fecklessness of some of these leaders has played in worsening this crisis, certainly in Italy, but impliedly also in Germany. The chancellor deserves a lot of credit for many of the things that she's done, but I think David really laid it out very clearly there. There is almost a cultural bias here, and almost a kind of, you know, a Protestant ethic being invoked against the profligate South. Suffer some. Be like us. Be like Germans. That's not going to work. Culture is anthropologists call it the extrinsic genes. You don't ask people to just become something else. And that seems to be what the Germans have been demanding these couple of years. And it not only doesn't it make economic sense, it's a cultural impossibility.
Maggie Haberman, more political and financial turmoil ahead in Europe, do you think?
I do. I mean, I think that I don't think I have much profound to add beyond what both men here just said. But I do think that this is not a clear path out. And to the extent that this is going to continue, I do think Berlusconi is going to go, by the way. But to the extent that that the measures that are being discussed are not going to produce any kind of immediate and or longer term change, I do think this is going to continue. And I do think that just to bring it back politically to a second to the U.S., I do think that you are going to continue to see this as the untalked about topic of the GOP race, because I think most of the candidates are having a very hard time getting their arms around how to address it and what it means in terms of how the U.S. With certain parallel issues could do things differently.
All right, on to Iran and nuclear weapons. The International Atomic Energy Agency reported this week that its investigators have amassed enough evidence to make a credible case to argue that Iran has carried out weapons development activity. Iran, of course, rejecting the findings as unbalanced and politically motivated. All the talk, or some of the talk this week, is will this new revelation, so to speak, ratchet up the pressure for a military strike? Here's Defense Secretary Leon Panetta talking about that at a Pentagon news conference yesterday.
You got to be careful of unintended consequences here, and those consequences could involve not only not really deterring Iran from what they want to do, but more importantly, it could have a serious impact in the region, and it could have a serious impact on U.S. forces in the region. And I think all of those things, you know, need to be carefully considered.
David Ignatius, perspective, how much did this report ratchet up anxiety, which was already running at kind of a high level in the West, about what Iran is doing?
The anxiety factor, I think, stems more from fears that Israel may be contemplating military action because of the Iranian developments that are outlined in the report, than stemming from the report itself. The report is a detailed, systematic, multi-source account of developments in Iran that simply are not consistent with the story that they've had about a peaceful program designed to fuel reactors, to, you know, do radiological therapy, this and that. You know, they're working on triggering mechanisms for a bomb. They're working on how you coordinate the detonation inside the core at the with the precise timings to get the bomb work. They're working on neutron triggers, so-called. I mean, this is very technical stuff that is consistent only with work on nuclear weapons. The question now, as it's been for some years, is what to do about it. And we've watched a weird debate in Israel, deliberately leaked, and then leaks about the leaks. But it's, the effect has been, I think, to raise more sharply this issue. What is the world going to do about this? The United States government has stated that it's unacceptable for Iran to have nuclear weapons. What does that mean? My friend Graham Allison, a Cambridge man, local man for all of you, has likened this confrontation with Iran to the Cuban Missile Crisis in slow motion. Graham Allison wrote The Great History of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I think there's a lot to that, that week by week, without something being done, we are heading towards a collision down the road. And as in the Cuban Missile Crisis, I think that the challenge for Obama and his people, which I think they're thinking very carefully about, is how do we think outside the box? How do we come up with ways to send signals, to project force even, that are not along the conventional bomb, bomb, bomb lines? Remember, JFK was being told by the chiefs during the Cuban Missile Crisis to bomb Cuba now. If you don't do it now, it's going to be a disaster. And he was smart enough to figure out other ways, and I know the Obama team is looking for parallel things to do.
You know, but will simple pressure work? Because we heard Iranian President Ahmadinejad this week categorically saying that Iran won't back off one iota, I think those were his words, from the path that it's pursuing. Is he daring the West to take action, or is he banking on no decision for a military solution?
Certain kinds of action that the West could take, that Israel could take, would help unify what is an increasingly divided political situation in Iran. Iran is going through a very interesting political crisis in which the president, Ahmadinejad, is at war with the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. The only thing they seem to agree on is how much they hate Israel and America. And so you have to be very careful that you don't, in reacting to the nuclear issue, provide a unifying device. That's why I think it's important to think about a continuum of power. There's things that you could do that might exacerbate the political problems for the regime without creating the backlash that would be so dangerous because it would unite them. And those are the kinds of options. It'd take another hour to explore them, but I think are being weighed.
All right, let's talk about Pennsylvania and Penn State University and the controversy embroiling the university this week in terms of the sex abuse scandal there. Pennsylvania State Police Commissioner Frank Noonan said Monday that football coach Joe Paterno, now fired, and other Penn State officials didn't do enough to stop the suspected sex abuse of children by the former assistant football coach Jerry Sandusky.
This is not a case about football. It's not a case about universities. It's a case about children who have had their innocence stolen from them and a culture that did nothing to stop it or prevent it from happening to others.
Jack Beatty, as we said, Paterno fired this week, as was the university president at Penn State. Has Penn State University done enough to stop the damage to its reputation?
It wouldn't appear to have. I haven't really followed this in any great detail, partly because it's just so repellent. I mean, the facts themselves, but also the non-action. I think the state police captain put it well in his report, where he said the lack of people taking, you know, showing moral responsibility. The young man who actually saw a rape going on, and instead of interfering and protecting the child, I think his next step was to ask his father what he should do. Well, you know, when you're grown up, you don't ask your father how to act. You act. You saved that boy. And it was just that, to me, is paradigmatic of how Mr. Paterno acted and the university acted. just a shameful thing all around. You know, I just want to return to Iran just for a second because it's so important. The original containment idea, containment of the Soviet Union, now explored in great detail by John Gaddis in a wonderful new biography of George Kennan, who came up with the idea. The original idea was not that you stopped the Soviet Union militarily. Well, that they had been stopped. But that you waited them out. You let the internal contradictions of that society bring it down. David was just telling us about the internal contradictions of the Iranian society. And the last thing we need to do is to, you know, interfere with those via force that would only, as even Israeli, Mr. Maya Dagan, the former chief of the Mossad, said, set off a new war in the Middle East. You know, we have John Abbasid, our general, in 2007, the commander out there, who said nuclear deterrence would work with Iran, quote unquote. We deterred the Soviet Union nuclear weapon. We waited them out. A nuclear Iran isn't desirable. It's much more palatable and something you can live with than the alternative, which is a war and all sorts of negative economic consequences.
Maggie Haberman, let me ask you: Do you sense on Capitol Hill that's where America's political leaders are? That they want to wait Iran out, or are they leaning the other way to take action?
My general sense, and I have not been covering this as closely as I have been the primary in the past couple of weeks and months, but my general sense is no. I think there is an uncertainty about which way to go, and I think it generally falls within party lines and fairly predictable political reactions. I think that you have Republicans who are using it to pressure the president and are using it to suggest that they would do a stronger job. They invoke Israel immediately as the go-to on it. And I think Democrats are taking a different tack.
What's the different tack?
I think Democrats are not quite sure what to do. I think Democrats are reluctant to pressure the president. I think you also have Democrats who are perhaps feeling closer to Israel in certain respects and are not happy with how the administration is acting, but are afraid to say that too openly right now.
And we also want to note as we end the show here today that we're very thankful for all the American men and women serving in the military for us. And again, a Veterans Day tribute to you. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website on onpointradio.org or follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks to our guest, David Ignatius, Maggie Haberman, and Jack Beatty. And again, thanks to you. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.